صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Liz Truss is officially UK's next prime minister. While her nomination is certainly not the envy of the town, there are many who are questioning her leadership abilities. For example, when it comes to foreign policy. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what her approaches will be and have been on some hot-button issues like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Ukraine conflict, UK's relationship with the Persian Gulf countries. For example, will she put arms sales ahead of human rights? And also what she thinks about Iran and the JCPOA revival talks or the sanctions removal talks. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Hafsakara Mustafa joins us. She's a journalist and political commentator who joins us from London. Also joining us, President of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Paris.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Hafsakara Mustafa, if I may. Taking a look at what Liz Truss will be facing in the foreign policy arena, I'm guessing the Ukraine conflict or Russia's special military operation would be probably at the top of the list. What kind of approach do you think she would take on that issue, you think?
Well, it's difficult to say, but I mean, given the examples she's given in the past as foreign secretary, I think we can fairly assume that it's not going to be a positive role or one of good leadership. She's shown herself to be a political lightweight with very little knowledge of the intricacies of foreign policy. And I think in this delicate time where any word can be interpreted and escalate a very volatile situation, I think she's obviously not a very good candidate. But of course, I think in some way, I think Russia is going to be very pleased with this nomination because it will actually add weight to their argument and the kind of politicians that they're putting on the stage. So if you put, for instance, Lavrov compared to Ms. Truss, I think you can see that Russia comes out far more stronger and has the ability to project itself as a firm and actually important international leader. And I think on that front, it puts actually Britain in a very weak spot because Britain has literally chosen as PM somebody who has very little knowledge of foreign policy. And I think at this time, it's very alarming.
What do you think, Mahmoud Rafat? Do you agree with what Hafsakara Mustafa has said there? What are your views on the way that Liz Truss may or may not approach the way the conflict in Ukraine is actually developing?
Well, let me, with all my respect to my colleague, but let me highlight very important and explicit reality. European Union countries and on front of them or on top of them, UK, number one, since 1945, the end of Second World War, are not really decision makers. The states of the European Union are not real decision makers in specific cases. One of these cases is the relationship with the other side of the world, in particular the Soviet Union and its heritage, somehow Russia now. They are not real decision makers. Also in the terrorism, also in negotiations with Iran, etc. In some cases, in the big lines, we can say, they are not the real decision makers. The real decision makers are the Americans. Orders come from Washington, D.C. And somehow, in some stages, we saw Jacques Chirac of France treating the things of invasion of Iraq differently. But at the end of the day, it's the whole European Union will not go out of the frame of the United States. And United States, and especially when I say United States, the administration of President Biden is insisting to face Russia in Ukraine until the last soldier of Ukraine, okay, as President Putin said. I agree with this phrase so much. So that's why I did not imagine any European country will go out of this dilemma and to have an independent situation. We saw here in France, President Biden at the beginning, President Macron, sorry, at the beginning, how he wanted to get out and to overcome this issue, especially France and Russia. They have both very historical relationships since the Caesarian Russia, before the Soviet Union. That's why they have this relationship has its own specificity, uh-huh, but he could not. We saw the German politicians as well, how they got broken, literally broken, when they wanted to raise their voice, oh, hey, let us be aside. We will be damaged and hurt seriously, especially with the gas. They were broken, all politicians who took this approach. So I don't imagine, at the end of the day, Europe will have its own independent situation, sure, far away from the American situation.
Hafsgar Mustafa, this special relationship is something that has defined and has been described when it comes to the UK and the US. And it was surprising to me, looking at some of the coverage of this issue, which actually has turned out to be somewhat not as cordial when it comes to Liz Truss. It seems, based on, for example, this one particular source, where it said that she needed the Russian president to suffer a strategic defeat. But the U.S. has actually backed a little bit away from that talk about my defeat of Russia. And if you remember when Joe Biden talked about how the Russian president needs to go, and then people said, well, he's advocating for regime change, and the White House had to backtrack on that. Do you think, and there's some other points that she's made on that, but how do you view it? Is Liz Truss an advocate of this special relationship with the U.S.?
I'm sorry, the sound has come and gone, so I've missed part of what you were asking. But I think in general, if we note that the reaction from the US has been more or less subdued, I think it's because overall, everyone accepts, and I think in Britain first and foremost, that Liz Truss is really a sort of transitional prime minister. We know that the Tory mandate has two more years to go, and therefore in replacement of Boris Johnson, she's got two more years to go. And as a result, I don't think we can imagine some sort of long-term strategy and some sort of mandate that will establish the Truss doctrine in future years to come. Hence why there's very little reaction, very little encouragement, very little sort of optimism over the nomination of Liz Truss as prime minister. I think also everyone, because everyone is very much aware that she is a lightweight on the international stage, including actually with European partners. I mean, remember just a few weeks ago, she said of France, which is, even though Britain is no longer in the EU, it nevertheless remains a close partner with France. And she said that the jury was out whether Macron was a friend of Britain or not, which is, in diplomatic terms, it's a major blunder, in particular at a time where all European countries have literally forged a front to confront Russia. So we're seeing a woman who has very little, who's not effective, who's in essence incompetent. And I think on the back of that, many world leaders are not trying to put too much spotlight on her, and in order to show that they're not going to rely too much on Britain as long as this woman is in charge. And obviously, fortunately, the idea is that she won't be in charge for too long. Hence, there's no real alarm bells ringing.
Well, Mahmoud Rafat, back in September, this is what happened when Liz Truss met the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken for the first time. She questioned the special relationship, and she even said that she had seen only a few tangible examples to support the idea of this relationship to be unique, where she said Britain has better relations with Canada, Japan, and Mexico. So basically it came down to what the U.S. has done for the U.K. lately type approach. Kind of goes against what you said earlier about this relationship.
Yes, well, the United States will never mind or will never put any obstacle for the Western states in general to be, I mean, European Union countries, Canada, Australia, all the West package to get complementarity, to get prosperity, to have their trade to evaluate and to get development. That the United States will never put opposition on that, because it's at the end that to strengthen the West, and just when the West is strong, the background and the backyard of the United States is strong by the strength of its allies. So that will never be opposite. But and I'm talking about some cases. Look, for example, let me give a small example, the terrorism. Until our day-to-day, there is no one definition for the terrorism, despite we have a country like France, it's one of oldest law states. We have a country like Italy, it's one of source of law along the history. Why? Because the United States, opposite to the Western world and the human rights world, to put a definition for the terrorism in order to play as according to its interest with this idea. I'm just giving this example sure. to understand that the West is not really allowed to go that far away from the decision and the frame of the United States. And this is, by the way, this is not a specificity on Americans. All winners of last world war and big empire ships along the history behaved like that. They gathered their allies around them, and the allies played followers in specific cases and in specific matters. So this is something in the international relations that I just wanted to highlight on. Let me go back just to Madame Truss. Madame Truss, well, now, even without the dilemma of Ukraine, but somehow and indirectly related to the dilemma of Ukraine, the economic situation in Europe, the shortage of gas while we are very close of winter, and the most important thing, that the way of treatment of this issue, of this matter, I mean the gas matter, the energy matter. Now, a few days ago, Minister of Economy of Germany announced, oh, hey, we have 82% in our stock now, so we are fine, we are safe. Russia cut the gas. Okay. That means the 82 can go until 50% or even less before the winter, which is a real catastrophe on Europeans. Just yesterday, only yesterday, the Sunday, the journal, non-journal Sunday, put a comparison. Everything in UK raised the price, and everything in Russia, which is under sanction, that its prices got down, decreased its prices, like okay. food, energy, medication, everything. So that reflects something. The Prime Minister of the UK, Liz Truss, is coming with paralyzed hand, literally paralyzed.
Okay, I understood your point there. All right. Well, let's move on beyond Ukraine and the domestic challenges. That's a whole other topic for a program here, Hepzibah Mustafa. But let's move on in the foreign policy arena. Of course, they might somewhat converge somehow, but let's talk about China. Now, she is very hot.
Much of what you're saying.
Go ahead. Do you have my voice? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, but it breaks up. Please go ahead.
I'm sorry. I want to ask you about China, what you think about the hawkish approach that she obviously has towards China, not only calling for a global NATO to defend Taiwan, but also for the first time, she may come out and classify China as a threat to British national security.
That's a good point. I think we have to distinguish between Liz Truss campaigning and Liz Truss as a prime minister. As a campaigner, and obviously because she's actually a professional turncoat. She was a Remainer and then became a Brexiteer. She was a Republican and then became a monarchist. So as a campaigner, she's obviously tried to appeal to some of the base of the Tory base in order to sort of stand up and come across as very firm and everything. But of course, once in power, she becomes faced with the real politics. And Britain, like the, my fellow panelists said, is no longer the world heavyweight it once was many, many decades ago. I think there's no way in any way that Britain can stand up and can be this hawkish towards a country that is now not only a superpower in military terms and in nuclear terms, but even in terms of its population. So I think these were words merely for the campaign trail and for the sort of the average Tory voter, knowing that these were the people who were going to get her nominated as prime minister. But I think once in number 10, she does realize that what she said then will not apply. And she's used to that tactic. So I think there's not much to worry about in terms of Britain's relationship or hawkishness towards China.
Sure. Well, West Asia, or the Middle East region, as some like to call it, is the next issue that will is going to fall in to her laps there, Masoud Rafat, or Mahmoud Rafat. And I'm going to go with your guess as to how she has said that human rights, even though she's going to hold Persian Gulf countries to account, she said, well, it's more important to do business with them. So does that mean she's going to put that before military sales, for example? What do you think?
Well, I don't think the new prime minister will give big attention to the human rights. Let me also put a spot on a reality that we have been noticing in the West last, let's say, 7 or 8 years since what happened in Egypt of with the Muslim Brotherhood somehow. I do not want to use any term here because I do not have any situation against that to be coup d'etat or whatever, or changement of president or revolution, whatever. Since this time, since 2013, that means 9 years ago, we have been noticing that the West in general reduce the value of the human rights because this card is no longer lucrative on the table. It used to be very lucrative to employ it against the regime of Mubarak, against Iran, against some countries here and where. Since 2013, somehow, and which is very contradictional, it happened, this decision was taken during the administration of President Obama himself, who presented himself as active of human rights. This card became not useless, but not that lucrative anymore on the table in the international relations. It's no longer the card which brings lots of benefits. That's why the West in general gave its back to the human rights, and that we have been witnessing that in lots of areas around the world, what happened in Saudi Arabia and President Biden, who came somehow on the legitimacy that he will do 1, 2, 3 with Saudi Arabia, and then we found them inside Saudi Arabia. What we saw also what happened with Israel and what has been happening with Israel, not what happened, but what has been happening. And allowing Israel to go more and more, deeper and deeper in the Palestinian blood and the settlement, which is the Palestinian land. So the question of human rights will not be the main interest. Okay. Maybe she will export some slogans, as usual, but on the camp of application, there will not be real application.
Very well. Well, human rights goes hand in hand when it comes to the occupied territories. Hafsakar Mustafa, she's obviously behind Israel on this. One example, when the war happened in August and Palestinians were being killed, children included, and women, she said the UK stands by Israel and its right to defend itself. So we know where that stands. What do you think? There's not going to be any difference, really, if we want to take a look between her and the way that perhaps Boris Johnson approached Israel.
Yes, I agree. I mean, unfortunately, that's where she'll probably likely to flex her muscles. I think, given that the Palestinians obviously don't have a state and they don't have the superpower that the other countries that she's flexing her muscles with doesn't apply to Palestine. And also, given that the Arab world is very fractured on that topic, especially since the Abraham Accords. So I think on that, that is the only area, sadly, where she's likely to sort of show hawkishness. And she's already promised that she would consider, she saw very favorably the idea of Jerusalem being considered the official capital of Israel by Britain. And I think given the power and the weight of the pro-Israel lobby domestically, that is also likely to impact her decision. Because obviously, as once again, given that she is an opportunistic political lightweight, she is likely to go wherever there is support, wherever there is likely to be benefit for her. And we have seen in the past 2 years how the pro-Israel lobby destroyed Corbyn over the course of his mandate as Labour leader, that they're very much likely to view anyone who blindly supports Israel favourably and support them all the way. And therefore, she knows that that's where her bread is going to be buttered. So she's very much likely to continue in this very pro-Israel stance, which is that of the Tory party and which was that of Boris Johnson in any case.
Well, we need to talk about Iran, Mahmoud Rafat, and what she has said, which was interesting in a sense and at the same time pretty shocking, was the fact that when it comes to the sanctions removal talk, she said, "I have been clear that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is not moving fast enough." And then she says, this is the shocking part, "I assure you that if the JCPOA collapses, all options are on the table." Tell us what you think about the way that she has approached Iran with that kind of a statement. And I'd like to put that into the context of how, when it comes to her mentality, this is one of the most shocking things that she has said. And that is the fact that when it came to nuclear weapons, she said she would be ready to launch nuclear weapons as prime minister. And here, she makes that statement on Iran.
Well, Madam Liz Truss, the new Prime Minister of the UK, is known to be a changing person, an unstable person. She doesn't have one line to walk on. And that reflects somehow a very high level of pragmatism. But this pragmatism is not well-directed. That means she's not, for example, the former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, who unified Germany by his pragmatism. No, her pragmatism is just to win immediately. What's winning the situation? And again, let me go back to the beginning of my speech. In the case of negotiations with Iran and the situation with Israel, here Europeans are not real decision makers. They can take very small decisions, and they have very narrow space to move in, like to announce this is against international law to build the new settlements, but not really to condemn and to cut relationship and to withdraw ambassadors and to help Palestinians and to push the International Criminal Court to in order to trial war crimes in Israel committed by Israeli soldiers and army against Palestinians. That will never happen. They will not go because until this level, they did not have that big space.
Sure.
This is the point.
We're quickly running out of time. I'm sorry. Let me just address the last question to Hafsakar Mustafa. Our guest there has said, Hafsakar Mustafa, on numerous occasions, that the EU as a whole and the UK as part of it, as part of Europe, doesn't have that much say. Now, I'm curious as to how much that's going to hold, given the precarious and fragile state that Europe as a whole is in, if the U.S. is leading it, and if that mentality that our guest there has is correct. Do you agree with his approach on the EU as a whole, if you heard my question?
I'm afraid I've only caught a few breaks of your question. But I mean, in substance, I think we have to also view the situation in light of the energy crisis that is looming. Britain is facing major disruption. And I think there is talk of major protests on a very, very wide scale in the coming months over the price of energy, which is now being blamed on the crisis in Ukraine. I think if the situation continues and if we people on the street, the average Briton doesn't see its politicians willing to make sacrifices and deal with governments that they don't like, I think the reaction is going to be very violent on the street. And I think that's one thing that we need to take into account, even in regards to Iran, which is a gas producer.
Thank you for that. Hafsatar Mustafa, journalist and political commentator from London, and Mahmoud Rafat, thank you, president of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tapoy and the team, this is goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, respect for people's personality. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of respect of people's personality in the Islamic lifestyle when we talk about the conditions of calling for good and forbidding evil. The second condition which we must look after in calling for good and forbidding evil when we want to perform such an obligation, it is necessary to have a respect for people's personality. Generally, we see that we pay attention towards our own respect. We expect people respecting us, and they should pay attention to us, and we have respect for our own self. Similarly, the others also have this respect, and it is in the fitrah, or the nature of the mankind, that he gives or pays attention to himself. But paying attention to the other's personality is from the Islamic lifestyle. In the Islamic teachings, it is necessary that we respect others, and with that respect, we should call others towards the good, and we should stop them from performing evil. If we cannot respect others, and if we do not have any respect towards the others' personalities, then obviously, when we perform the calling for good and forbidding the evil, it will make people running away from us. We cannot bring people closer to ourselves. We cannot attract people towards the goodness. And that is what Islam is saying, that you must have the respect for the people's personality, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the conditions of calling for good and forbidding evil, and we reached to the second condition, which is respect for people's personality. And we said that it is necessary because Islam pays attention to this topic and it stops others. Even we have that the prophets and the saints, they used to stop some people from performing this obligation, which is calling for good and forbidding evil. Why? Because these people did not have a good personality. They were not respecting others. They did not reform themselves. So there are conditions. So the second condition is you must have the respect for people's personality in order to perform the calling for good and stopping from evil. We have in history a narration that one of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he used to perform sins sometimes. He used to perform mistakes in his life. He had it, and he used to do it on and off in his life. But there was a time when he came to Imam alayhi salam, and he asked him for the help, and there when he asked him for the help, Imam alayhi salam has said to him that إِنَّ الْحَسَنَ مِنْ كُلِّ أَحَدٍ حَسَنٌ. When someone performs a good deed, it is good. When someone performs good, it is good. وَإِنَّهُ مِنْكَ أَحْسَنُ. But when you perform it, it is better. It's not good, it is better, it is higher. لِمَكَانِكَ مِنَّ. Why? Because you're related to us. Because you're known as our companion. That's why when you perform a good, it is better. وَإِنَّ الْقَبِيحَ مِنْ كُلِّ أَحَدٍ قَبِيحٍ. But when someone performs a bad deed, it is a bad deed. وَإِنَّهُ مِنْكَ أَقْبَهُ. But when you perform something bad, it is worse. It is not just bad. So this is how Imam has explained him, that he has made a respect for him, that remember that you're connected to us. And if someone performs good who is connected to us, it is known as better. But if you're performing a bad evil or the bad deeds, it is worse. So our followers must stop from performing bad deeds, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode. God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For the first time since the beginning of the UN brokered agreement in April, Yemenis are waiting in long lines in front of a limited number of operating petrol stations in the capital Sana'a to refill their vehicles. Yemen is suffering from a fresh fuel shortage due to Saudi Arabia's ongoing blockade.
The Saudi-led coalition wasn't sincere in implementing the terms of the armistice, and it did not open flights to other destinations from Sana'a Airport, and the salary issue still persists. The enemy is still using various methods to pressure the Yemenis, such as seizing fuel ships. But our leadership is studying the positions that can be taken regarding the Saudi violations of the UN armistice. There will be an appropriate decision at the right time, as the leadership is keen to move towards a solution to end the war.
The Yemeni Petroleum Company announced the implementation of the emergency plan and is distributing fuel to a few stations only. It held the United Nations responsible for the consequences of the Saudi violation, as it did not ensure the implementation of the armistice terms that included allowing fuel ships to enter Yemen without any restrictions.
The fuel crisis that the liberated areas are experiencing contradicts the United Nations statements that there is a smooth flow of entry of fuel ships into the Port of Hodeidah. If there had been a smooth entry, we would not have experienced this crisis. The UN is a clear partner in decision posed on the Yemeni people because it did not force a Saudi-led coalition to implement what was agreed upon. We hold the United Nations responsible for the continued violations of the Saudi-led coalition.
Since the beginning of the truce, only 33 fuel ships out of 54 have entered the country. However, Riyadh is still holding 9 fuel ships despite them obtaining UN permits, and this is a clear violation of the UN agreement.
Observers believe that the Saudi seizure of oil ships and the Yemeni army's recent military parades indicate a return to military escalation. They say the UN brokered truce has failed to achieve tangible results in relieving the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. Avlatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Liz Truss has begun celebrations after winning the race to become the new leader of the ruling Conservative Party, making her the next British Prime Minister, beating her rival finalist Rishi Sunak and taking over the post from her predecessor Boris Johnson. The Foreign Secretary, who won 81,326 votes of Tory members to the former Chancellor's 60,000, takes over from Boris Johnson, who was ousted by his own MPs earlier this summer.
I'd like to pay tribute to my fellow candidates, particularly Rishi Sunak. It's been a hard-fought campaign. I think we have shown the depth and breadth of talent in our Conservative Party. Friends and colleagues, thank you for putting your faith in me to lead our great Conservative Party, the greatest political party on earth.
The feeling of joy over her victory will not last long. Truss has taken over a car crash economy and a so-called zombie government. Building a new cabinet, formulating an effective energy plan, and figuring out how to remove pressure of the severe cost of living crisis are all top of the agenda.
Things in Britain do need to change. We need some new policies, because what's been happening recently is there's a cost of living crisis, an energy crisis. Inflation is at its highest amount for several decades now, and this is alarming. Britain's economic future is quite bleak. Businesses are suffering. Indeed, there could be the position that many factories may have to close, perhaps temporarily, because simply they cannot afford the fuel bills. So something, in a sense, must be done.
Truss inherits a deeply divided party, lagging in the polls, and a long line of past scandals have left many experts fearing lasting damage to Tory electoral prospects. Truss won't officially take over until Tuesday after a meeting with the Queen alongside the outgoing Mr. Johnson. However, her next big fight will be to convince the wider electorate that her premiership has a future. Robert Carter, London.
Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, three times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinians have staged a rally in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to mark the first anniversary of the Gilboa prison break, also known as the Freedom Tunnel operation. In September of last year, six Palestinian detainees escaped from the Gilboa maximum security prison in occupied northern Palestine. They managed to get out through an underground tunnel in the prison's drainage system. Hamas resistance movement has vowed to secure the release of Palestinian detainees.
On the first anniversary of the heroic Gilboa escape operation, we salute the six prisoners. Securing the release of all prisoners is a top priority for Palestinian resistance factions. The six escapees will be on top of the list of any future prisoner swap deals with the Zionist entity.
The Israeli regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. The Israeli prison service keeps Palestinian inmates under deplorable conditions. The prisoners have also been subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Palestinian prisoners escape from Israeli prisons because of the horrible detention conditions. They suffer from inhumane treatment, and hundreds of prisoners are held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention.
Palestinian prisoners regularly go on hunger strikes and protest at the regime's administrative detention policy and harsh conditions. Palestinians are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
We call on all international human rights organizations to step in and protect Palestinian prisoners. There are thousands of prisoners, including children and women, in Israeli custody. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from all forms of oppression inside Israeli jails.
Currently, around 5,000 Palestinians, including children and women, are languishing inside Israeli jails.
People here consider Palestinians held in Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters who continue to struggle under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Yemen is facing a fuel crisis as Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to block fuel ships in violation of a UN brokered truce and steal the country's crude oil. Yemen's Ministry of Oil has held a press conference in Sana'a to discuss the issue.
There are 13 oil basins in Yemen, of which only two are invested, namely Safar and Al Masila. At a rate of only 18%. These basins are located in Marib and Shabwa, and they are controlled by the Saudi-backed forces. They are continuously being looted, and this reflects negatively on the Yemeni economy. The systematic looting is one of the reasons for the years-long war against us by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The ministry says the plundered oil is worth billions of dollars, which is enough to pay the suspended salaries of Yemeni employees. It held the Saudi-led coalition responsible for cutting off the salaries as the oil sales are being supplied to Saudi banks.
What the Saudi-led coalition is doing is the systematic looting of Yemeni oil and gas. The total amount that was looted from 2018 until July 2022 is about 130 million barrels, with a total value of about $9.5 billion. This money is enough to pay the Yemenis suspended salaries for 5 years. Unfortunately, they give the money from the plundered oil to the National Bank of Saudi Arabia and not to the Central Bank of Yemen.
Yemen's petroleum company warned of an imminent fuel crisis as Riyadh is still preventing 9 fuel ships from entering the country, which is a clear violation of the UN brokered truce. However, the world body remains silent toward the Saudi violations.
As Yemenis face a fuel crunch due to the Saudi blockade, they are urging the United Nations to force Riyadh to fulfill its commitments under the ceasefire agreement and to stop detaining fuel ships headed to the country. They say pillaging Yemeni oil also reveals why the Saudi-led coalition launched a war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Did the UK authorities cover up the trafficking of 3 British schoolgirls who joined the notorious Daesh terror group back in 2015? That is the question now being asked following shock allegations revealed in a new book, which claims that Canadian intelligence officers informed British police that the girls had entered Syria with the help of a double agent, Mohammed al-Rashid, who provided information to Canada on who he had smuggled to ISIL. One of the girls involved is the former UK citizen Shamima Begum, who is currently fighting for a return to Britain under the argument she was groomed by traffickers.
An inquiry has been demanded after it emerged that Canada knew about the teenager's fate but kept silent while the Metropolitan Police ran a frantic international search for the trio. The book has claimed that Canada privately admitted its involvement only when it feared being exposed and successfully asked British authorities to cover up its role. The scandal has now reopened the debate over stripping Begum of her nationality.
Following the latest allegations, we spoke with the Begum family lawyer for his reaction.
Now, the reason that was rather egregious for us was because we had asked specifically the Met Police at the end of March 2015 about updates regarding anything that could be coming of use from al-Rashid, and they confirmed that they had no updates, and that clearly is not the case if what Richard Walton is saying is actually true in this book. This revelation about a Canadian security services asset being one fundamental element that allowed these girls to cross over, well, that speaks against error. It speaks more to a concerted, securitized effort to have these girls go across, and that's actually true of the Canadians. The question remains of whether other security agencies who were working with these girls, with these handlers of this Canadian asset, who wanted the same thing. And that's a question, and that's why an inquiry is very important.
A spokesman for the UK government said they do not comment on operational intelligence or security matters, but choosing to remain silent won't be enough to quell the growing questions surrounding the way Western intelligence dealt with Daesh or their sophisticated smuggling operations, which saw so many Westerners slip through the net, including the young and vulnerable. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's Kish airline is back to Afghanistan. Afghan and Iranian officials have welcomed this in a ceremony at Kabul's International Airport and stressed the importance of closer economic cooperation between the two countries.
We're happy today and welcome Turkish Airlines. We have very good relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran and do our best to expand cooperation in the political, economic and social fields.
This airway can be very helpful in the economic and cultural fields. I think such flights will soon be welcomed by other airlines as well, and that makes transportation between the two countries easier.
Iran has always tried to help boost Afghanistan's economy, and the resumption of Kish Air flights to Afghanistan can be considered another positive step in that regard.
Considering the changes that have taken place in Afghanistan since last year, the number of people coming from Afghanistan to Iran has risen, and that demand should be met. This is not enough, and we need to do more, and such activities are very effective in boosting economic relations between the two countries.
In recent months, Afghanistan has been deprived of many sources of international aid and even its own financial assets held in the United States. Now, Afghanistan's cooperation with Iran appears to be vital to the country's economic growth.
Such economic activities in cooperation with other neighboring countries promise the improvement of Afghanistan's economy by providing job and investment opportunities for people and for businessmen. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, 3 times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
In the limelight.
The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has criticized Zionist regime's crimes against innocent Palestinian prisoners, saying that the martyrdom of some prisoners in jail reflects the policy of lingering killing of detainees in Israeli prisons. Palestinian detainees have endlessly resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at their illegal administrative detention. Zionist regime jails authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under dire conditions without proper hygienic and health standards. Palestinian inmates have also been subject to systematic torture, harassment, and repression. Human rights organizations say the Zionist regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to Palestinian prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media to shed more light on the issue. Stay with us to hear more about the story. The website of Middle East Eye has published an article concerning this issue, saying Palestinian groups have charged Israeli regime with medical negligence that led to the martyrdom of prisoner Musa Harun Abu Mohammed on Saturday, September 3rd. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club, PPC, the 40-year-old was detained 2 months ago while attempting to enter the city of Al-Quds from the occupied West Bank for work. Israeli forces claimed he did not have a permit to work in Al-Quds at the time. His family said he was suffering from a neurological disorder before his arrest and that his condition deteriorated in jail. He was transferred to Asaf Horway Hospital at the beginning of August. The PPC said that Israeli authorities informed the family of Abu Mohammed that his body would be handed back for burial later on Saturday, September 3rd. The PPC noted in a statement Abu Mohammed was subjected to the crime of deliberate medical negligence. Abu Mohammed's martyrdom comes days after some 1,000 Palestinian prisoners suspended their hunger strike after Israeli prison authorities accepted to their demands to reverse harsh measures imposed across prisons for months. The strike was part of a series of escalating steps the prisoners had adopted since February amid the Israeli refusal to respond to their demands to reverse measures taken against them following the escape of 6 prisoners from the Gilboa prison in September last year. Palestinian rights groups charged Israeli prison services of adopting a systematic policy of deliberate medical negligence against Palestinian detainees. Palestinian Center for Human Rights website pchrgaza.org wrote, Abu Mohammed's martyrdom sheds the light on the general deterioration of Palestinian detainees' conditions in the Israeli jails, as there are 7,000 Palestinians, including 175 children and 32 women, detained in 23 prisons and detention facilities inside the occupied territories in inhuman and cruel conditions that lack the standard minimum rules of the treatment of prisoners and detainees in detention. Among the detainees, there are 600 ill detainees. Some of them suffer chronic and serious diseases. According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, 231 security detainees have attained martyrdom in the Israeli prisons, including dozens who have martyred due to medical negligence policy since 1967. PCHR hereby holds the Israeli occupation authorities fully responsible for the martyrdom of Palestinian detainee Mohammed, who is the fourth detainee attained martyrdom in Israeli jails since the beginning of 2022, and for the lives of hundreds of ill detainees who would face the same fate if the policy of deliberate medical negligence continued, especially under the unhealthy imprisonment conditions where prisoners are denied adequate healthcare. Similarly, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, said, calls for a prompt and impartial investigation into Mohammed's martyrdom circumstances are needed. It also calls upon the International Committee of Red Crescent, ICRC, to intensify and ensure efficacy of their follow-up of the conditions of Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails and their imprisonment conditions. Also, it calls upon the international community to compel Israel to respect the rules of the international law and international humanitarian law, in particular the 4th Geneva Convention and the UN standard minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners. Moreover, SaveTheChildren.org said, children in the Israeli military detention system face inhumane treatment such as beatings, strip searches, psychological abuse, weeks in solitary confinement and being denied access to a lawyer during interrogations. The charity Save the Children consulted more than 470 children from across the West Bank who have been detained over the past 10 years. It found that most children were taken from their homes at night, blindfolded with their hands painfully bound behind their backs. Many of the respondents said they were not told why they were being arrested or where they were being taken. Every year, hundreds of Palestinian children are detained by Israeli authorities. They are the only children in the world who are systematically prosecuted through military rather than civilian courts.